TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti, The Struggle for History. Dissident Truth and Official Deception. In this talk, Michael Parenti quotes Winston Churchill, who said, "History will be kind to us because I plan to write it." Far from being an objective account of events, history bears the mark of its writer, the omissions of the censors, and the interests of those who benefit from making it. In this speech, Parenti shows how to take the recording of history back from politicians, the media, professors, clergy, and business people. Michael Parenti is one of the nation's leading progressive political analysts. He has taught at colleges and universities in the United States and abroad. Michael Parenti.
Thank you very much. It's such a fine turnout, it almost makes the place feel cozy. I want to talk about something other than the headlines of today. I'd like to discuss a rather academic subject, which is history, even more academic than that, the study of history and the production of history. I want to talk about things long past, yet very much with us, which is why some people talk about the living past, you know. And I think the study of history is not only a discipline, it is itself a political act, and it's part of the political struggle. The people who control this society, the people who control the dominant communication universe, they know this, and we ought to know it too. Investigations of the past are usually motivated by something more than trying to find out what happened in the good old days. The effort to define the past is part of the struggle to control society itself. The study of history is much too important to leave in the hands of historians, nor is it ever left in the hands of historians exclusively. I mean, along with historians, for better or worse, are all sorts of people, including political leaders, publicists, press pundits, clergy, textbook publishers and school teachers and others are all involved in the manufacturing and marketing of a history whose function quite often is not to enlighten, but to indoctrinate. The term history refers to both the actual course of events and the study of those events. I'm going to hear mostly, as I said, concerned about the writing and dissemination of history. But the distinction between these two is not absolute. Those who write history actually have an impact upon it. Their observations affect the things that are being observed. So the process of observing and defining affects the things that are being observed, affects our definition of them, and affects how we act upon them, or don't act upon them, or don't even know about them. They help control history's course by defining its dominant themes and influencing our understanding of what happens. Conversely, those who make history, especially those who occupy elite policy positions, often manipulate the materials needed for recording it. They will destroy or repress information. They'll introduce distortions at the point of production or at the point of origin, well before the history is even written or even played out. I remember what Winston Churchill once said to his Tory associates, he said, "Gentlemen, history will be kind to us because I plan to write it." And by the way, with that same intent, all sorts of political leaders, with that intent and with the $2 million advance they get from the publisher, all sorts of political leaders hurry forth and produce their memoirs to justify their policies and positions and manufacture official histories. This process of controlling history at the point of origin is not left to chance, but it's pursued systematically by policymakers and official agents. By the way, any researcher who ever works in government archives, I spent a year in the National Archives in Washington, D.C., are you struck by how many documents are missing, how things aren't available? Some things have never been cataloged. Many things remain classified for 50 years. I was talking to Morris Morley. Morris Morley's a fellow political scientist. He teaches at Macquarie University in Australia. and he's a friend of mine, and I saw him in Washington. He was in Washington looking at the Jimmy Carter records of, his expertise is Central America. He collaborates a lot with James Petras. I said, well, Morris, did you uncover some real good stuff? He said, most of it is still just classified. 20 years later, we cannot critique Jimmy Carter's policy in Central America because the documents aren't free. It's worse than that. The War Department records on the Lincoln assassination conspiracy were kept secret for 60 years. They were finally placed in the public domain in the 1930s, after all possible conspirators were pretty much gone. Theodore Roscoe, he was researching the murder of Lincoln. When he was doing it, he discovered that some Civil War records in the U.S. Army intelligence were still classified almost 100 years after the war. 100 years they were still classified. Now, what question of national security could be involved here? I mean, how many Confederate spies are lurking behind the Union lines in 1960? Roscoe was writing 1960. There's the famous and utterly disastrous Battle of Passchendaele in World War I, also known as the Third Battle of Ypres, in which the British commander, Sir Douglas Haig, sent an entire army to its destruction in order to advance 900 yards deeper into an indefensible bog. In fact, the Germans retreated to let him take the bog, because it would be perfect. The German mustard gas surprise attacks at Passchendaele were so devastatingly successful that British army records were virtually stripped clean to conceal the truth from the British public. Official histories put British casualties at a fictional 238,000. Probably closer to the truth is what General Haig himself said right after the battle, his horrified private admission. My God, have we really lost 500,000 men? The point here is that this battle was fought in 1917 and they're still lying about it. Most of the statistics and other documentation still remain a secret in the United Kingdom. Dennis Winter, who wrote a book about Haig and did some investigation into this, he found better archives in Australia and Canada. See, some of the documents hadn't been cleaned out. Some of the hadn't been cleaned out as thoroughly there. When he wrote his book on Haig, he found all sorts of funny things started happening. And this guy was writing in 1988, 89. In 1989, suddenly command records disappeared, minutes and memos disappearing. Documents evaporating in thin air. The cover-up by Haig and the British High Command began the first year of the war in 1914, and it continues into 1989-90. You know, he even found in Haig's, the diaries that Haig kept, that he actually bought a whole other set of notebooks that had the same year as these notebooks, and he would tear pages out and then put pages in with a new date, which showed him prescient. You know, he'd say, I believe the Germans might try this and this and this. Amazing and all this stuff. And you could tell that these were the pages put in because the carbons were missing. And Winters points out that this guy was, in the middle of the war, fabricating history. A more important example, which doesn't involve the incompetence and venality of a particular institution like the British High Command, but the power of a dominant class, is offered by the historian Carol Quigley. For 20 years, Quigley studied the Cecil Rhodes, Lord Alfred Milner, Oxford Group, the Round Table, as we call them. They had that official publication, the Round Table. The Round Table, which had such a decisive influence on British policy from 1891 right through World War II. And Quigley himself, by the way, was very close to establishment elites in this country and in Great Britain. After teaching at Princeton and Harvard, he spent the rest of his career at Georgetown School of Foreign Service. He was a consultant for the Brookings Institution, the Pentagon, the State Department. If he wasn't CIA, he was very close always to the policy circles and types that were. And not surprisingly, Quigley, by the way, was in total agreement with most of the policies of the Roundtable elites. But he was bothered by some of their methods, and he thought their inherited wealth and power held terrifying implications for democratic governance. This is what he said, quote, "No country that values its safety should allow what the Milner Group," that's Lord Milner, the Roundtable, "what the Milner Group accomplished in Britain, that is, that a small number of men should be able to wield such power in administration and politics, should be given almost complete control over the publication of the documents relating to their actions, should be able to exercise such influence over the avenues of information that create public opinion, and should be able to monopolize so completely the writing and teaching of the history of their own period. Unquote. But does that sound familiar, by the way? The suppression of history, the JFK assassination papers. Now here's an issue that's been settled. The case is closed. There's nothing to hide. And yet the archives aren't open. A government that says there is no case, has nothing to hide, yet hides all sorts of things, including Lee Harvey Oswald's tax returns. We want to just find out who was paying him those years, how he managed to live. Can't get that information. His links to military intelligence, the disappearance of documents, the disappearance of JFK's brain, the disappearance of testimony of witnesses, and the disappearances of the witnesses themselves, or the odd, strange deaths of them. The examples of how history has changed and distorted, suppressed, fabricated at the point of production are, brothers and sisters, too numerous to record. We see it all the time happening before our very eyes. Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, that vignette of him shredding documents while the FBI was right there in the office next to him, lackadaisically thumbing through the files at the, not saying to him, hey, don't shred those documents. We see the fabrication of the point of origin, the canonization of Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon, the saintly president. And to see representation after representation, image after image, and not a mention of the fact that this Richard Nixon carpet bombed Cambodia and Laos and Vietnam, leading to the death of tens of thousands of people. Brutal B-52 carpet bombings, relentless bombings of them, escalated that war and pursued it and prosecuted it with a savagery that made LBJ look mild. Not a word about that. They just said he inherited the Vietnam War and then finally ended it in 73. The great statesman of peace. Not a mention of his destruction, his murder of democracy in Chile, the murder of Salvador Allende, a dedicated democratic president, the backing of a deranged murder machine of the Chilean military. Not a mention of it. Didn't hear a word. But we heard he wasn't perfect. He wasn't perfect. He made mistakes at Watergate. Mistakes? A felony break-in is a mistake? Use that the next time a cop stops you for speeding. Say, I made a mistake, officer. What is 90 miles an hour on a 50 mile? It was a mistake. Okay, I won't do it again. So you see right there, it's being filtered out. 50 years from now, any historian who consults the newspapers around Richard Nixon's death is not going to get an inkling of a whole dimension of his policies. Historians are fond of telling us that history reflects the age in which it's written. Our perception of the past is heavily influenced by our experience in the present. Indeed, Benedetto Croce made that famous statement, all history is contemporary. Along with Croce, Collingwood, quote, I quote Collingwood. We studied Collingwood in grad school, I remember, in my methods class, we all read it, oh, yes. Collingwood, quote, St. Augustine looked at Roman history from the point of view of an early Christian. Taillemont, from that of a 17th century Frenchman. Gibbon, from that of an 18th century Englishman. But there's something left unsaid here. People in any particular age do not perceive the past in complete agreement. In fact, they don't even perceive the present, their own particular experiences, in complete agreement. So why should we think they agree about the past? The differences range, therefore, not only across the ages and between nationalities and civilizations, but within any one society. Gibbon was not just an 18th century Englishman, but an 18th century English gentleman, well-educated and conservative, who lived comfortably and occasionally hobnobbed with nobility. a white male, prosperous enough to spend nearly 20 years of his life writing his magnum opus, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. He might have had a much different view, by the way, of ancient Rome if he had been an impoverished, self-educated cobbler trying to write history in his spare hours late at night in a coal shed. He might have maybe said something about the slaves, you know, and the oppression or something. And by the way, it's no accident that Gibbon wasn't a cobbler or a day laborer. Poor people have neither the time nor money to produce historical tomes. Neither then nor usually today. And this leads us to another point. If there's a variety of perspectives in a society, the one most likely to prevail is not necessarily most representative of the people, but of the select few who are materially endowed. History, ladies and gentlemen, history is written by those who can afford to write it. And and if it's true that people tend to perceive reality, both past and present, in accordance with the position they occupy in the social structure, then it's likely that most of the history that has been handed down to us is affluent white gentlemen's history. I mean, most of it, by the way, was intended to be read by affluent white gentlemen at elite schools, so it's not too much to conclude that it was written by the same social group. With every conscious intent or unconscious inclination, I mean, not be conscious, it could be unconscious, part of their whole breeding and training, education, to reaffirm the existing social order as the best of all possible arrangements. So we have what I call dominant history. Consider how the Middle Ages are perceived. History books tell us that the Middle Ages were deeply concerned with, that the people in the Middle Ages were deeply concerned with religion. The historian E.H. Carr raises an interesting question. He says, I wonder how we know this. I wonder if it's true. I mean, someone of his stature raising that question. I wonder if it's true. What we know as the facts of medieval history have almost all been selected for us by generations of chroniclers who were professionally occupied in the theory and practice of religion, and who therefore thought it supremely important and recorded everything relating to religion and not much else. I'm quoting Carr. He goes on. The picture of the Russian peasant as devoutly religious was destroyed by the revolution of 1917. You know, the peasants start killing the priests and burning down the churches and doing things like that, which devout people don't usually do. The picture, Carr goes on, the picture of medieval man as devoutly religious, whether true or not, is indestructible because nearly all the known facts about him were pre-selected for us by people who believed it and wanted others to believe it. A mass of other facts in which we might possibly have found evidence to the contrary has been lost beyond recall. It is the religious scribes who wrote history, so they wrote it religious, as you know, from the religious perspective. By the way, this historic fact is entombed in the very French word clerc, which can mean a clergyman, a scholar, or a clerk. And during the Middle Ages, they tend to be, you know, all one and the same. Even in English, clerical as an adjective can mean clerical, administrative, or it could mean clerical interest, the clerical orders. Okay, this being the case, the peasants had virtually no opportunity to speak for themselves. When I wrote this all down, this is my own summation, I note, by the way, there are historical studies concerning peasant communities in the Middle Ages, but very little direct testimony by the peasants. They are the muted masses you don't hear. Then as I was sitting there, I was finished with Carr, I thought, wait a minute. A few years after Carr wrote, there was a remarkable publication that came out. It was the Inquisition Register of Jacques Fournier, Bishop of Pamiers, transcribed in 1318 to 1325 at Montaillou, a village in southern France. And it was retrieved from the Vatican Library in the 1960s, and it was the three surviving volumes, there were originally five, we don't know where the other two are, and they were published, complete. A subsequent sociological study by Emmanuel Leroy Ladurie developed from the volumes offered a vivid and detailed description of peasant life and attitudes. What it was several years of inquisitional hearings in this village in the regions, in which they questioned the peasants at great length. Again, the source is what? A religious one. It's a total monopoly. They're the ones who wrote it all down. But this time there was direct testimony, very rich testimony by the peasants on how they lived. And La Durie's book happened to be right on my shelf over there, called Montaillou, and I raced over and picked it up, and I started going through it. I spent the rest of the night reading the whole book. And the Montaillou study reveals a people who were concerned about with much else besides religion. Property, farming, pastures, livestock, cooperative communal services, crafts, festivals, courtship, marriage, family relations, personal friendships, love affairs, including cohabitation without benefit of marriage. One woman testified that her lovemaking, with a priest no less, was not a sin and did not displease God because, quote, I liked it. Well, cynic that I am, I immediately suspected that the priest gave her that line, you know, that unusual theology. But I was wrong. I was wrong, because she went on to testify in perfect sincerity. She said that now that she no longer sleeps with him and doesn't like sleeping with him, it would be a consummation without pleasure. It would be, in her term, a cold consummation, and that would be sinful. Very interesting. These peasants knew a thing or two about life. The peasants in 1318 wept more easily than we do, generally, both in happiness and sorrow, and they usually were loving toward their children. Less than half of the Montaillou parishioners attended church. Now, there's an interesting datum. Less than half of them attended, and many of those who did so without any special enthusiasm. One villager remarked to a group of men in the community, quote, instead of burning heretics, they ought to burn Bishop Fournier himself because he demands that we pay tithes in lambs. The bishop was ripping off their lambs, their sheep. By the way, Fournier himself became Pope Benedict VII. This statement was treated as a blasphemy against God, but in fact it was a secular criticism. It was a class protest about class exploitation. In fact, much of the heresy in Montaillou was anti-clericalism. That's all it was. It stemmed less from theological fervor and a search for salvation, and more from egalitarian rejection of the lies, corruptions, privileges, and economic thievery of the upper clergy. So, I mean, the impression I got is that these peasants were not so much involved in church affairs as the church was involved in their affairs. They didn't fear God, they feared the Inquisition. So Professor Carr's suspicions seem to be confirmed by Professor La Durie's in-depth view of peasant life. But the point to remember for the purpose of the present argument is that the evidence regarding Montaillou is not likely to overturn the dominant history, the one that treats the feudal peasantry as composed of devout, simple, stolid serfs. The prevailing image is of the masses as more or less accepting their station in life in a symbiotic relationship with their superiors. And by the way, this was the image created by the churchmen themselves, an image of the common people that is preferred to this day by elitist scribes and Pharisees. So it cannot be said too many times, the writing of history has been and still is principally an elitist undertaking, a privilege of the victor written from within the court, the church, government, the academy. It was Caesar and not those he vanquished who chronicled the conquest of Gaul. But who speaks then for the people of history? Through the centuries, there have been scarcely anyone to record their glory and their miseries. No one to take note of the Roman commoners who wept for loved ones lost in Caesar's wars, the peaceful villages obliterated by the conqueror's holocaust, the women torn from their hearths and homes by the military rapists and plunderers. We hear of the glories of Charlemagne, the first Holy Roman Emperor, but we don't hear of the men who enslaved and who died, worked to death in Charlemagne's mines. Came from Eastern Europe, most of them. Few chroniclers over the centuries have recorded how the course of history was changed by the women and men who created the crafts and generated the skills of civilization, who developed horticulture and designed the first wagons, seafaring vessels, fishing nets, the first looms, lathes, kilns, who cultivated the first orchards, terraces, vineyards, and invented the written word. Those who did what Thorstein Veblen, the great American economist, called the work of civilization. And by the way, he had in mind mostly women who did that in most of these societies. Because the men were usually out bashing little animals in the brush, or each other, or hanging around. Not then or not now are they celebrated for their contributions to history. I'm reminded of the poem by Bertolt Brecht. It's called A Worker Reads History. I'll quote just the first part of it. Who built the seven gates of Thebes? The books are filled with names of kings. Was it kings who hauled the craggy rocks of stone? And Babylon, so many times destroyed, who built the city up each time? In which of Lima's houses, that city glittering with gold, lived those who built it? In the evening, when the Chinese wall was finished, where did the masons go?
That was part one of a two-part talk by Michael Parenti, The Struggle for History, Dissident Truth and Official Deception, recorded by KPFK in Los Angeles in May 1994. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Come back for part two of this program when TUC Radio returns. Michael Parenti is one of the nation's leading progressive political analysts. He has taught at colleges and universities in the United States and abroad. With roots in a working-class Italian district of New York and a PhD in political science from Yale, Michael Parenti has become an internationally known lecturer. You can find out more about this program on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. TUC Radio has moved to Northern California. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. TUCRadio.org. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD or DVD order keeps this program on the air. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.